thank you very much for joining Chris Pederson and myself for our first combination video and podcast discussing one of the most important topics of my whole career. In fact, it is my belief that this is probably the work that we'll talk about today going to have the most impact on investors of any of the work that I've done. So this is very special to me, and I hope you find the work as interesting as we do. Now, I have focused on trying to educate people and educate them to understand, but not just understand, but understand enough and believe enough that it motivates them to change. And that change would suggest, hopefully, a strategy that would produce better returns, a strategy that would expose the investor to less risk or no more risk than they were already taking, and a strategy that created more peace of mind. And I know that we have been successful in doing this with a lot of investors because people email us and they tell us what it's done to them and their attitude and their sense of peacefulness about their portfolios and their confidence. But I've also had a lot of emails that suggest to me that I've seriously failed. And why have I failed? Because when I was in the business managing money, there was no problem having a complex a portfolio that had lots of moving parts because it wasn't the investor's responsibility to do all that heavy lifting. And so people could say, I'd like to do that, and they knew it would get done, and that was all it took. But this work that I've been doing since I started the foundation in 2012, it is in large part for do-it-yourself investors. And guess what? It turns out that a lot of people don't like to deal with 10 or 12 different mutual funds or ETFs, and they don't like to have to deal with rebalancing and all those complexities. In fact, they don't particularly want to be kind of inside the process. So what are we going to do better for you, particularly those of you who either yourself would like to find a much simpler way to invest, or maybe it's a matter of trying to help others that count on you, but you know they wouldn't want to deal with all those moving parts. And so with the help of Chris Pederson, as a matter of fact, it was 99% Chris Pederson's work. And I was just rooting for him to keep going because he has done a marvelous job creating what we have called the Two Funds for Life strategy. And that is what we're going to focus on today. When this podcast is released, I will have just turned 75. And if our work is going to make a bigger impact, it needs to be easier to get into the investment, and it needs to be more likely that that investment will allow the investor to stay the course. So this new strategy is as close as I am likely to come to meeting the goals of easy entry and easy maintenance. I had dinner last night with Chris Pederson and Daryl Balls. Daryl is the gentleman that does most of creating the tables that we use to make the case for what we believe is the best way to invest. And we talked about what it is that we are looking for in an investment. And what is interesting, even though I'm far older than the other two gentlemen, is that we're all looking for simplicity. And not just simplicity for ourselves, but the topic that came up around the table was, what about the simplicity when we're no longer there if we predecease our spouses? So this strategy may even have some application to those of you who feel that you really enjoy the complexity, but you might question whether or not that surviving spouse would. So my hope and my dream and my expectation is that the two funds for life is an answer that will make sense to millions. I'm dreaming big here, millions of investors. So let's get to it. And again, right before I introduce Chris formally here, I want to bring you right up to date what got us to this point today. We did an article a couple of weeks ago, or I guess a little over a month ago, about the three great investment products, the greatest that I know. One, the mutual fund, first introduced in 1924 by Massachusetts Investors Trust. The second, the index fund, introduced by the Vanguard family of funds in 1976. And the third, the target date fund. That was introduced, first one was brought to the public by Wells Fargo in 1994. And by the way, it's interesting that Vanguard did not get into that business until 2003. And here they are 15 years later, not just the biggest by far, they have over 40% of the target date fund business, but they have more under management than the next three big providers. So they have definitely become the giant, and that is one of the reasons that Chris and I will be focusing on Vanguard as we go through some of the slides today. So now it's time to introduce, formally, Chris Pederson. We've had Chris on a couple of podcasts before. He has been working with us at the Merriman Financial Education Foundation now for 2 years. He gets paid exactly the same as I do and has not asked for a raise yet because zero is zero, okay? But he has devoted a lot of time and energy, just as Daryl Balls has as well. So what we have now are a series of graphics that Chris and I will be going through. Chris has a background both as an engineer, he's a scientist, but he also has an artistic background as well. And I think it's a great combination. In fact, we're going to be talking a little later about the question about art versus science when it comes to investing. But at this point, Chris, thank you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for
all of the work that you've done. You're remarkable, absolutely remarkable. So let's take a look here at these slides that we've produced, you've produced, to be fair, and let's start to talk about the target date fund. How does it work? Why does it work the way it does? And then we'll get into how we think we can improve it.
Sure. The target date fund work, you asked me to work on this, I think, maybe 2 years ago when we first started working together. And then it took us a while to get into it. And one of the foundations I had to start with was understanding why they're built the way they're built. And so one of the things that I learned in digging into target date funds is that we all have a lot of potential and ability to take risk early in our life, and that declines as we get older. And a lot of people manage that in their portfolios by taking more bonds, more fixed income over time to get less volatility. And the reason we have that ability to take more risk when we're young is that we have time on our side, right? We have time to recover from a loss if the market goes down. We have time for compounding to work for us. We have longer years to work to make more money, to save that money. And we also have contributions that are relatively large compared to what our balance is. Like the first month you have zero and the next month you got whatever you put in, right? So if the market goes down, well, you just put another chunk in that's equal to what you had and you hardly see it. So there's this declining risk over time, risk profile or risk tolerance that people have. And what target date funds do is they try to automate it. They try and make it so the investor buys into a target date that is associated with the year they think they'll retire or close to it. Mm-hmm. And then the fund automatically aims to lower the risk as you get closer and closer to retirement by shifting the mix from a lot of stock, a lot of equities, to more bonds. So that's the gist of target date funds. And I think it's, like you said, it's one of the most valuable products that's ever been invented for investing. It's almost like a robo-advisor on the cheap, right?
It is. Yeah, that's what it is. In fact, theoretically, it's reproducing what the pension manager used to do for you when
exactly.
you got a pension. And that's one of the reasons I think that I think over 50% of every dollar now going into 401ks is going into target date funds, and that's growing at a high rate. So they're a wonderful, wonderful product. Question is, what's wrong with them, and what can we do to fix that? So what's the next step?
Well, one of the things that we've noticed and you've commented on over the years is that, you know, in these early years at the age of, say, 25, where you have this high risk tolerance, there's bonds in the target date fund. And that's a bit of a mystery. Why would you have bonds at a point in time when you have the ability to take a lot of risk? And as I was doing my research, I came across this quote from Vanguard. It was out of their Vanguard's approach to target date funds, which mm-hmm. describes the philosophy of how they design their funds. And I think it's really instructive. It tells us why Vanguard and others take perhaps a more conservative approach. And the quote is, if maximization of wealth is the primary goal, then higher equity allocation would be an appropriate strategy. However, this does not account for the downside risk that investors would need to withstand on a short-term basis.
Those are the magic words, a short-term basis. And what is it that people tell us is that the biggest mistake that people make is to look at investing on a short-term basis. Everybody says it's about the long-term, and yet they force on people that bias that is costing investors probably for that first 20 to 25 years about 0.5% a year. When I met with Jack Bogle in June of 2017, this was one of the reasons I flew back to Pennsylvania for the express purpose to sit down and find out from him why they have that 10%. And he actually made a very interesting case, because when I was an advisor and I was helping people manage their money, in almost every case, the goal, long-term goal, was a combination of being able to produce income in retirement, being able to give some money away even while you're not working, being able to leave money to others after you're gone. So it was, in almost every case, the focus was on living the good life and then leaving a legacy. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Bogle made the point so clear that what they're doing when they build a target date fund, they are not worried about a legacy. They're worried about people having enough money to stay the course to live and cover the expenses of retirement. Mm-hmm. And if they end up spending the last dollar on their last day, then Vanguard was successful in helping them get there. And I don't disagree that's an honorable goal. And they believe with that piece of bonds in there, that 10%, which seems so harmless, but it is not harmless, that will give people some peace of mind when the market goes down. It will give them a sense that and begin to understand why bonds are there, which I think is at some level means that they're afraid to educate them and they're afraid that they won't stay the course. But if they don't stay the course, they don't get what they're after in the first place either. So, I mean, Bogle could be right. He could be wrong. I'd rather take the time to try to educate people and do it right.
Yeah, it as we'll see when we go through this, you can do much better if you don't have the bonds in there. So the question is, do you have the temperament to withstand a little bit more drawdown on a short-term basis, right? That's really what it comes down to. And I'd like to think your listeners do.
Yes.
So that's what motivates us to keep pushing forward.
Yep.
But it's possible that Vanguard just chooses this path because they want to have something that fits the widest possible audience and keeps people invested through the worst of times, right?
For the average investor,
yep.
I mean, that's basically what it's about.
Yep.
And we're trying to create above average investors without putting them at undue risk. Well,
yes.
let's move on and learn more about what your research. How did you build this?
Well, the biggest question I had was what is the risk? What's the risk? What is that short-term risk? How much more drawdown would somebody experience with a different strategy? And how bumpy is the ride going to really be? And what's the risk that you're going to have more or less when you come out the other end?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so to figure that out.
No, out the other end means when they turn 65 as opposed to the end of their life.
Yeah. I figured 40 years is a good lifetime of work. So I ran my analysis for 40 years. And last year when we did this, I did it with a Monte Carlo simulation when we designed the various target date fund options and came up with the aggressive one. And we'll talk about that at the end. This year, I had access to a much deeper set of data, thanks to Daryl. So I had the monthly returns for 1970 to 2017 in almost every asset class that we needed.
Mm-hmm.
And then I also had the asset class returns on a monthly basis back to 1928 for a smaller set. So instead of doing the Monte Carlo simulation, this year what I did was a back test, which means you take the target date fund glide path, the asset allocation that's changing with time, the asset class return history, and then you pick a start date and you figure out how it would have done for 40 years. And then you pick the next start date and you figure out how it would have done for 40 years. And you keep doing that.
On a monthly basis.
On a monthly basis, exactly. And so we can see the drawdown, how far it would have been. We can see what the end balance is that you get off the when you retire or when you have gone through all 40 years.
Drawdown. Define drawdown, please.
Drawdown is how far down you come from your peak, right? So if you looked at your balance at one point in time and you saw it was $10,000 and then you hear bad things are going on in the market and you go back and you happen to look at the worst possible moment and you see that it's $8,000, your drawdown is $2,000 or 20%.
And that drawdown isn't over until it gets back to $10,000. I mean, that's the way drawdowns
that's right.
are finished.
Yeah. But the depth of the drawdown is just to the lowest point. Yeah.
Right.
To the lowest point.
Right.
Exactly.
On a monthly basis. And the reason I say that is because some people might see our numbers and notice they're a little different than the worst drawdown they might see someplace else. But that might have been taken to the actual day.
Could be day.
So there's going to be some small differences.
Yeah, so the other thing I had to do in the analysis, just, you know, full disclosure, is something called circular bootstrapping. So if you want to exercise the target date glide path across every history that you have potentially, that means at some point you run out of history, right? If I start 30 years before 2017, I can't do a 40-year simulation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So what we do then is we go back to the beginning and we go back to 1970 and take another 10 years if that's what we need. And I compared this to the Monte Carlo simulation and the results were quite similar. So I feel really confident in the answer. And I love that we went from an annual analysis, which is what we had last year, to the monthly, because this is more what somebody would actually experience and feel going through it. So that was the approach we took. And
by the way, I might mention, I guess we can look at this in a minute, but that first graph there, the target date fund glide path, there are a lot of different colors there in that particular one, and that's because this is actually showing us how much in bonds. When did they stop putting 10% in bonds? Turns out it's age 40.
Yep.
And then there's this gradual increase in bonds all the way to age 65. In fact, here it goes to age 70. But then underneath there, it's not just the S&P 500. When you look at what Vanguard holds, they hold a little bit of small cap. They hold a little bit of international or some international, not much international small cap, and a lot of S&P 500. But you've done a nice job of showing all the different colors so that people can get a sense through that Vanguard-like target date fund what that glide path looks like.
Yeah, and that graph, that asset allocation graph on the left-hand side, is the closest we could come to what we actually see in the Vanguard Target Retirement Funds. They have tips, for example, that they use in the later years. I don't have a long asset history on tips, so we modeled that with intermediate-term bonds. So there's some approximations in here, just because of the historical data that we have and the knowledge we have of what they have in their funds. But it's as close as we can come to the Vanguard Target Retirement Fund, and we chose it because it's the one that's most broadly used. And
it's our benchmark.
We
want people who are putting money into a target date fund to do better than that and sleep easy. What can we do to move toward that?
Yeah, so the short-term risk question, it's hard to answer when you run. There's 576 periods of time in that 1970 to 2017, 576 months you can start at, right? So if I've got 576 months when I can start, what do I say about the drawdown? I can't tell you that the worst case drawdown was a single number, because it depends on when you start. It depends on how lucky or unlucky you are. Mm-hmm. So what I've done to show how that drawdown experience shapes up is this graph on the right-hand side. And you can see the age on the horizontal axis going from 25 to 65 years old. And on the vertical axis is the depth of the drawdown that somebody would have experienced. But because there's all of these different scenarios, it's a statistical kind of thing, right? So you have some drawdown depths that happen often. Yep. You have some drawdown depths that happen very, very infrequently, and then you have the absolute worst case. And so the way I've drawn this, the black part at the bottom is what you might expect in a quarter. You might expect a drawdown depth of maybe 3 or 5%. That'd be pretty typical. Every quarter, you might see a 3 to 5% drawdown. Every year, you might see a 20% drawdown, quite a bit higher. And every 10 years, you might see a 30 or 40% drawdown. Mm-hmm. And the worst case is actually pretty close to the same as you'd get out of the tables, the fine-tuning tables mm-hmm. that Daryl produces mm-hmm. of about 50%.
Which, by the way, from 1970 through 2017, happened three times.
Right.
And so this was the worst, but it happened more than once,
right?
If you want to look at it that way.
Right.
So
it can happen more than once.
But I think, I don't know that you've mentioned yet, that what we're looking at here in this particular graph is the assumption that a person comes along on day one with a lot of money.
Yep.
I mean, it's a lump sum. Maybe they're, I mean, it's like at 75. If I took all my money and I put it to cash, and then I took that cash and I put it in the market, this would be the exposure to risk that I would have, because this is so different than the person who's building from nothing, from scratch, and dollar cost averaging and all of that. Those people who are scaring young people that they might be taking too much risk, I think when we look at the next slide, what we're going to learn is they're not taking much risk at all.
That's true. That's absolutely true. This is the lump sum investment. Just two more things on the graph before we move on.
Sure.
The bottom part of the graph is the 1970 to 2017 mm-hmm. history. The dashed line that's up higher is what we see if we go all the way back to the Great Depression and use substitute asset classes that are as close as possible. And not surprisingly, if you go all the way back to the Great Depression, the drawdowns were much higher. So we included that on the chart because we could, partly, but also as a just a reminder that there is risk in the market, and it can vary with time and history. And it depends on what you live through, right? So we hope the future looks a lot like 1970 to 2017 and that the Great Depression never comes back. But for people interested, the data is there.
So, well, and also it gives us a chance to see, though, if we create, as you do, that Vanguard lookalike going back to 1928, we can also compare it to the portfolios, the two fund portfolios, yep, to see how different it was over that whole period and compare it to the 1970 through 2000. It's all, I think, going to be a great lesson, but go ahead.
Yeah, so the last thing to look at on this chart, and then we'll move on to the next one, is, you know, what happens with age? Mm-hmm. When you're on the left-hand side of the chart, the bars are high.
At
age 25 to 30, the bars are relatively high. That is when you would expect to be taking the most risk. And as you go to the right, when those bonds start to kick in around age 40, you notice that the bars all get shorter, right? There's less risk. So this makes it look like the target date fund is doing what it's supposed to do. And if you were a lump sum investor, it actually is doing a pretty good job. But now, like you said, let's take a look at what happens when we look at this for somebody who starts with a balance of zero, mm-hmm, and contributes $10,000 per year on an $833 per month basis.
And let's stop right there, because every time we talk about somebody putting away a sizable amount of money, and $10,000 is to a 25-year-old is a lot of money, I'll get emails about who has that kind of money to invest. Well, actually, a lot of young people do. Sometimes they're couples.
Yep.
Sometimes they're frugal as can be. Sometimes they're engineers. I mean, they're people who are coming out of college and making a pretty good, yep, pretty good living. They're people who are getting a match on their 401k contributions. That could get them there. But even beyond that, it's not about the $10,000, really, because you could say, I can't do that. I could do five. All right, divide all these numbers by half, and you have the outcome for you for the amount of money that you would have, and you could compare all these strategies there just as easily as with 10.
Yep, absolutely. And it could be $1,000 per year and divide by 10. It's whatever. Yeah. Just picking a round number to make it easy for people to do the conversion. So that's a great reminder, though.
And we want them to put away $10,000 if they can.
So if we look at the difference between these two charts, it's pretty dramatic. Now that we're putting the money away starting with zero, there's almost no risk in those early years. How did that happen? What happened to all the risk? The standard deviation on the returns, the amount that the returns of these assets have every year, which is the normal way people look at risk, is the same. Mm-hmm. So how did the drawdown change? Well, what happens is that as the market is going down, you're contributing money. You're buying cheap. You're buying when funds are low. Yeah. Yeah. And so from an investor perspective, you don't see the drawdown being nearly as dramatic. If you imagine the market being down 10% just before you make your contribution, if you look that day, you'll see a 10% decline. But if you put in money and then you look a day later and there's another 10% decline, you may still be up, mm-hmm, depending on how much you put in relative to your balance. It's pretty dramatic, and it really reinforces this idea that you have a lot of ability to take risk in those early years, and it really draws into question why you would need the bonds there to smooth the ride.
Absolutely.
Because you have such a smooth ride already from the contributions going in.
And I think it's important to teach these young people, and I think that some older people need this as well, that when we look at a lifetime of investing, we're going to make money first and foremost because we invested. And that's going to be a big deal. And we'll see what that relationship here in a few minutes is between what you put in and what it was worth at the end of a period. But the other is you're going to have something because markets have generally gone up. Understanding we have yet to recommend our first individual stock. We did not recommend Apple. We did not recommend Google. Certainly everybody wishes maybe that we had, but we also didn't recommend Washington Mutual or Eastern Airlines. And so what we're talking about is being able to confidently say that for young people, being able to put money into a declining market is amazingly good, not bad. And to the extent that they do get hit some, yeah, they do lose some potentially, but it's such a small amount. I had people, young people, tell me in 2008, and it always made me chuckle, well, I didn't lose any money in 2008. I made money for the year. Yeah, you added money into your small portfolio, and so by the end of the year, it was your saving that made money. It wasn't the market. But the next year, the market came on and made them money, made them a lot more than they might have added. I don't know. But this is a good lesson for young people in particular.
Yeah, and we're not saying that young people don't experience the market downturn, that the assets they have invested don't decline. They do. They do decline just like everybody else. What we are saying is that the emotional ride that they're on, the way they feel it when they look at their accounts, is much smoother than somebody who had a large balance and is making no contributions. Mm-hmm. And that should help them stay invested. That's just a really powerful, positive thing for them. So that's cool.
Great. Ah, I love these.
So given that we now have this way of kind of thinking about how risk declines with time and an ability to model how the risk declines in our baseline Vanguard-like target date fund, we wanted to figure out what we could do better. What kind of things could we do to help an investor who wants to take a little more risk, and maybe Vanguard is the target retirement fund they have. It's quite likely it is in their 401k. What could they do to improve? And so we're going to look at two examples today in the initial set of slides here and walk through them in some detail. The first is to invest in small cap value, which is an asset class we know has a history of great returns per unit of risk. And I think of it in some ways as being the anti-bond. You know, bonds are secure and stable with a lower return, and small cap value is an asset class that has more volatility, more return. So what would happen if somebody invested 10% of what's going to their retirement savings into small cap value and didn't rebalance? And the reason we said they wouldn't rebalance is thinking that for some people, they may not have small cap value available in their 401k. It's not always there, and so they may need to be doing that in an IRA, a separate investment account, and rebalancing would be problematic between an IRA and a 401k. So that was one thing that we modeled. And the interesting thing about that, because you're not rebalancing, is that the asset allocation ends up being a little random. It depends on the history you experience. But we were able to model it for lots of different periods of time, and we'll show what that produced. The other thought we had is, what if you want to preserve this idea that your risk is declining with age, but you also want to add in a different asset? So if you want to have the risk still decline with age while you add in small cap value, you'd really like to have the amount of small cap value you've added in decline with age. And so we produced a model for that where we said, take 1.5% times your years of age. So if you're 30, 1.5% times 30 is 45. So you'd have 45%, and you put that in the target date fund. By the time you get to 66, 1.5% times your age is 99. It's near enough to 100. You can call it 100. So by the time you retire, you're out of small cap value as a second asset. But what that does then is it gives you an ability to take this additional risk to offset the bonds and hopefully get a better return. So that's what we modeled.
So the people who are looking at these graphs can see this very clearly. First of all, the Vanguard-like target date fund starts with a lot of fixed income, 10%. And then at age 40, it gets bigger and bigger, and it represents over 50% of the balance, or about 50%, over 50% at age
60.
That's
70.
At
65, so it's about
50-50 at 65. Now, by adding that 10% in small cap value, what you know is immediately the amount of money in the bonds is going to go down a little bit because you've added more equities to the portfolio.
On a percentage basis.
Yep, on a percentage basis. What's happening, though, is that small cap value historically, and if people have not seen our collection of articles and tables about small cap value, we'll have a link to that whole series, because it's, if you haven't read it, I hope you will, because there's a ton of historical data there. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean the future will look like that, of course. But what I see is, as I'm getting older and older and more conservative, I am getting more risky, because that small cap value is making me a lot of money historically. And enough that 10% is being, in this particular case, is worth more than 50% of what you got at age 65.
Pretty close to.
All right. Now, then, if we look at the last one, where we end up starting with a lot of, we just reverse it. We start with a lot of small cap value, and then we go downhill and lower and lower and lower risk as we get older. That's what most of us probably would rather, if we had to take a risk, we'd rather have that one than the one that starts with a little and ends with a lot.
Right. Yeah,
because we're going to chicken out somewhere along the way. This one where you put in the 1.5 times your age, that one looks to me to be a lot more emotionally likely. Now, having said that, a person was going to want to know, all right, but how much money do you have at the end? I mean, which one actually put most money in my pocket? Show me the money. Can you show me the money or not?
I can show you the money. Of course we can show you the money. Of course, we can't guarantee you the future money, but we can show you the past money, okay. Which is that's all we got, right? So we modeled these all three of these options, and all doing monthly contributions. The Vanguard baseline end balance, the average end balance is $7.93 million. So that's after putting in roughly $10,000 a year, increasing with inflation.
That's the only increase. And why did you increase it for inflation?
Two reasons. Number one, most people don't have a constant income throughout their lives. Their income tends to grow, right? The second thing is some of the histories have a lot of inflation in them. Mm. And some of the histories actually have negative inflation in them, right? Mm-hmm. And the returns on the assets tend to be shaped by that as well. So if you were somebody who lived through the 70s, your income may or may not have matched inflation every year, but over the long term, it probably came close. Mm-hmm. So it just seemed more realistic to try and mirror the historical periods that were being experienced in the model.
Better than certainly just adding 3% a year. I mean, that would have been the way a lot of people would have looked at it. Just add 3% more every year for the raise you might get.
So we used the actual historical inflation rates that we had. And so it came out at 7.9 million, 7.93. The lowest that ever was experienced in the 1970 to 2017 histories was 3.5 million, 3.49 actually, and the highest was 12.8 million. So if we look at that and compare it to the 90% target date fund plus the 10% in small cap value that's not rebalanced, the average goes from 7.93 million to 10.3 million. That's a pretty big jump.
That's a big deal.
So maybe you would think, because I've taken this more risk, the low would go down, right? Because the bottom of the Vanguard-like was 3.49 million. But when you take this unrebalanced extra position in small cap value, the worst case scenario came up to 3.9 million.
Mm-hmm.
And the best case went from 12.8 to 18.2 million.
I like that, yeah.
So it performed very well. And we also looked at the multiple of contributions. So money out versus money in. Yeah. Add up the pile of money you put in. Look at what you got out. For the Vanguard like, it was 8 times more money you get out on the other end on average. For the 90% target date fund plus 10% in small cap value not rebalanced, it was 10 times. Mm-hmm. So you're getting quite a bit more out. And then we also plotted how the fund did relative to the baseline for every different period of time. That's this.
How Vanguard-like did versus, in every case, every period of time, how did the Vanguard-like target date fund versus the 90-10?
How they compare.
Two fund strategy, how they compare. And the answer was?
The answer was it was always better. And sometimes it was better by a lot, sometimes better by a little. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about that is it tells you that luck matters, right? It tells you timing matters. You could have a period of time where you take this approach and you see very little difference, that it doesn't really help you that much. It's just, it's luck. But you could also see a period of time where it did much better. And the fact that it never did worse, that's pretty encouraging.
It wasn't luck that you saved money.
No.
Everything else, in a sense, at some level, is going to be luck.
Yep.
And I think also a big warning on this one, because I would love to think that the people following this strategy would get these kind of returns. This was a lucky period as an investor, because look at this. The target, the Vanguard-like target date fund, had an average money-weighted return of over 10%. And that a lot of that time, in fact, all the time, it had bonds in it.
Yeah, but bonds did pretty well.
Bonds did well. Stocks did relatively well.
Right.
So,
yeah.
And you had the dollar cost averaging working for you too.
Right.
Right? I mean,
yep.
So.
Yeah. Moving on down, the drawdown data comparing these two is interesting as well. So the Vanguard-like versus the 90% target date fund plus 10% small cap value have very nearly the same drawdowns. It's the worst case drawdown is 46% for Vanguard-like and 48% for the 90-10 split unrebalanced, which is almost, it would be hard to resolve for most people. I think the difference is tiny. So that's the good news. Now we get to the bad news for this scenario. And that's that as you're nearing 65, your drawdown potential is a lot higher. And it's because of what we talked about on the previous slide. You've probably got too much in small cap value. Still, you've probably got more money than you would have had in the other strategy. So the fact that you've got a higher drawdown potential might be okay. But the worst drawdowns at age 65 were 26% for Vanguard-like and 37% for the 90-10 split. And you can see it in the graphs at the bottom. They're, you know, it's much higher on the right-hand side.
It's not going to happen very often. I mean, that's important. That doesn't mean that you have a high probability of losing 26% or 37% the first year. In fact, if you look at the 1 out of 10 year, it looks like it's even lower than that. I mean, so
yeah, it's so, quite a bit. It's about 2/3 of that.
Yeah.
Something like that.
So the bottom line is, during that first 10 years of retirement, you can kind of expect to lose something like 20% if you stay invested in a balanced portfolio.
Anyway. Yep. Yeah, so that was instructive, and it taught us that you could do better with some small cap value. Now what happens if you move over to the far right-hand column on our chart here, which is this 1.5% times age in the target date fund and the rest in small cap value. Well, it's interesting because the end balance still goes up even above the 90-10 unrebalanced. So the average end balance is 11.5 million now, instead of 10.3 million for the 90-10 split or 7.93 million for the Vanguard-like. And the worst case is still better. The worst case was 4.79 million.
Almost a million more.
Almost a million more than the 90-10 split or the Vanguard-like, which was 3.5 million. It's more than 1.3 million more. And the high end, the best case, was 18.79 million. So the monthly balance, the end balance that you can end up with that strategy is higher. The multiple of contributions is higher. And it even delivered more consistent performance. If you look at its performance relative to the baseline Vanguard-like, it's almost all blue, which means that it beat it all the time and fairly consistently.
Yes.
But the question is, did it address the drawdown issue at the end, and did the worst case drawdowns get much worse? Well, instead of 46% for the worst case drawdown of Vanguard-like, it's a 50% worst case drawdown for this scaled strategy. Mm-hmm. And the age 65 worst case drawdown is 2% higher. So instead of being 26%, it's 28%.
So but it's nominal.
Nominal.
There's something else about this page, and I always want, particularly young investors who are looking at having a 40-year period. It isn't just that you have, let's say, let's call it 8 million versus 10 million versus 11 million. I'm rounding here. It's that when you retire and you take 4% out of a number. Well, as a matter of fact, you've got so much more with the 11 million than you do the 8 million that you might take 5% out of it, but it's 5% of 11 million rather than 4% of 8 million. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then you live for another 30 years. We're not recommending huge risk for anybody after 65. In fact, that's one of our next projects, is what people should do after 65 with all this money. It means that this multiplies more over a lifetime, not just for you to spend, but to leave to whatever legacies you feel are important to you. So, all right, where do we go from here?
Well, we've got a bunch of conclusions. After we did all that modeling, I think we learned a lot. We learned a huge amount. So one of the things we learned is that target date funds definitely are not optimized for wealth maximization. Yeah. And, it comes straight out of the Vanguard quote, but you can see it when you model them too. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're maximized to minimize risk and mm-hmm. to keep people invested. Another thing that we learned is that augmenting the target date funds with small cap value is a good way to increase end balances. Mm-hmm. The higher end balances that we saw were also reliable. We saw in all of the periods of time between 1970 and 2017, augmenting with an additional fund, small cap value in these cases we just looked at, would have served you well. Not one period of time would it have been a mistake, mm-hmm. which is not just reliable, it's actually very reliable. The higher end balances were earned by tolerating slightly deeper drawdowns. Yep. So for somebody to get these returns, you have to have the temperament to deal with.
It wasn't free.
It wasn't free, yep. But 2% higher drawdown, 5% higher drawdown, it's not
one
that
time,
expensive.
One, yeah,
it's not yeah. that expensive. Now, if you go way back to 1928 and you look at those dashed lines, the drawdowns can be much worse. And in the article that we'll publish, and maybe some of the data we'll touch on in future podcasts, we'll show all that. You can see that actually in the article that's on the website. The 1928 period of time was much, much worse. Mm-hmm. But it still served investors well to do all the things that we're advocating, to stay the course, not to sell low, not to abandon the market while it was down, to continue dollar cost averaging into it while you went through it.
By the way, we did a piece maybe 2 months ago about small cap value, what could go wrong. And what could go wrong would be 1929 to 1938.
Yep.
Worst 10 years, to the best of my knowledge, in modern stock market history. And yet, if you dollar cost averaged over, without inflation adjusting, just dollar cost averaged over that 10-year period, with small cap value, it was about a 10% compound rate of return, not a loss, as it would have been on a lump sum investment.
Right.
And with the S&P 500, it was about a 7 or 8% compound rate of return. Again, this difference between old people and young people is night and day. And yet it's the old people who are kind of pushing the kids where they should be. And too often I fear that we old people leave a taste of risk that's totally different for us and what it is for their children, which I think you've made a great case for. Do we have actually more conclusions here?
Just a few more. So the not rebalancing raises risk as you get closer to retirement. And that would be true not just for these target date fund combinations, but for any portfolio.
Mm-hmm.
So if people think that by not rebalancing, they can raise their returns, that's probably true.
Yeah.
But it also comes at a cost. It comes at a cost of less stability. Just a few more. The age-based allocation, so ramping down the secondary fund in small cap value with age, works really well for taking the risk out and preserving that risk-reducing characteristic that a target date fund is supposed to deliver.
Okay.
So that worked really well. And you just made this point. The resilience of young investors is amazing, right? It's almost impossible to have high drawdown risk in those first 5 years of investing.
I've got an article. It's $1,000 a year, or invest $1,000 a year. And grow to a million or something like, actually it's a lot more than a million. But what I did was I showed the implications of $1,000 a year into the S&P 500, $1,000 a year into a worldwide equity strategy, so it had big and small and U.S. and international, and $1,000 a year into an all value. It wasn't a target date fund, but it was the major equity asset classes. What is interesting is in the S&P 500 is the one I remember. There were only 6 out of 48 years that you ended up with less money than you had at the beginning of the year. 6 out of 48.
Wow.
And so it's just huge, that ability to be starting with nothing. And it's that they have time. That's the asset they have.
Yeah.
I don't have that asset anymore of any note.
Yeah.
But they do, and they should take advantage of it. What else you got?
Augmenting the target date fund with small cap value equities increased the end balance for all of the historical periods. So the strategy is one that if you can stay the course, history suggests you have a really high probability of benefiting from it.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that really is striking is that just saving is not enough. If you just saved the money and you didn't invest it,
you'd never have a losing month. Ever.
Well, you'd never have a losing month, but you'd have 1/8 the amount of money in Vanguard-like at the other end.
Right, but I was saying if you didn't even put it in a target date, because there are millennials today,
yep,
who are only putting their money in cash or in bonds. They aren't. I think something like 23% are unwilling to put money into equities. And they are on a path, well, I hope they like working, let me put it that way, because they're likely to work for a long time to save enough, particularly if they run into any inflation of note. Anyway, it's...
Yeah, well, in the strategies we just looked at, you get 8 to 10 times the money out that you put in.
Mm-hmm.
So taking that market risk is really, really critical to having enough in retirement.
Exactly.
The most aggressive approach that we just looked at was the least risky in the long run.
Yep.
So if you can stomach the 2%, 5% added drawdowns along the way and stay invested, not sell low and buy high, if you can do that, history suggests you've got a very, very good chance.
We should write a poem about that. Yes, and luck matters.
Absolutely.
There is no risk in the past. Now, are we not going to have a chance to look at those other strategies? Because I'm going to cry if we can't look at those other strategies. Because I think that, can we do it now?
Yeah, we can do it.
I don't know how long we've been talking. How long have we been talking? Anybody know?
50 minutes.
Yeah. Okay, yeah, we got time.
We can do it in 10 minutes.
We got time.
Yeah.
Sure, let's take a look. So for those of you on the podcast, my apologies, because I have a lot of data here. We'll try and pick off some of the highlights. And so for those of you watching the video, we'll put it up on the screen and probably zoom in on some of the more important parts. In the article, we covered a much wider range of options just because we thought it was interesting for people to know what they look like. It'll help. A lot of times, do-it-yourself investors are going to modify what we recommend anyway.
Yeah.
So we looked not just at the Vanguard-like and the 90-10 unrebalanced, but we also looked at an 80-20 mm-hmm. unrebalanced. So that's 80% in the target date fund, 20% in small cap value. A 70-30, which I put in there as much as anything is to test the limits, because now you're really taking risk as you get close to retirement. And then on the 1.5% times age in the target date fund, we thought that we have the small cap value for the rest, but we also thought some people might not have access to small cap value.
401ks or don't have small cap value as often as we'd like.
Right. We know they routinely have small cap or large cap value. So we modeled those, and we modeled a combination of large cap value and small cap value just to see what would happen if you wanted to be more diversified and have both of those. And then just to really mix it up, we thought, well, what if somebody wants to be more aggressive but still ramp it down on age?
So start with more value, small cap value at 25 or whatever.
Exactly, okay. Right. Okay. What if somebody wanted to be all small cap value at age 25 and zero at age 66? And so for that one, actually at 65, we did a 2.5% times age minus 25. So age minus 25, if you're 25 minus 25, that's zero, times 2.5% is zero. You got 0% in the target date fund.
So you're okay. 100% yeah. small cap value for yeah. a while.
For 1 year.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You're right.
Because 40 years later, at age 65, 65 minus 25 is 40, times 2.5%, you got 100% in the target date fund. And so we modeled that as well, just to give people a chance to look at something that would still reduce risk with age, but be even more aggressive early on. And then we have the Merriman Aggressive Target Date Glide Path that we came up with last year.
And now, tell us about that, because you mentioned robo-advising earlier.
Uh-huh.
And that is another kind of a target date fund. That's what they do. And they charge something for that. And what you've done is create portfolios that are meant to act like a robo-advised. They do act like a robo-advised, except you have to do a little something, but you don't have to pay anything, right?
Right.
I mean, that's pretty neat. And it gives us the ability to do exactly what we want in terms of the asset classes. Now, I get to tell people what the bottom line number is, because it's more than twice what you would have gotten out of the Vanguard Target Date Fund. And it's here's small cap value. It's about 80% higher than what you would have gotten from the small cap value at 1.5 times your age. But tell us about the portfolio, because obviously it is more aggressive.
It's much more aggressive. You know, basically what I got to do last year when we were working on the Merriman Aggressive Target Date Glide Path approach was play Target Date Fund Designer. And so I created lots of different options with input from you and from Daryl. And we knew we wanted to tilt more towards small in value in the early years. But we wanted to gracefully migrate all of the asset classes towards something that looked more like a worldwide balanced ultimate buy and hold plus bonds fund. So
At age 65? At about.
Yeah, at age 65. So it's less, if you, we don't have the glide paths in this presentation, they'll be in the article that's on the website. But if you compare it to taking 1.5% times your age in small cap value, you have a straight line down of small cap value while all of the other asset classes are a constant percentage of what remains, because that's the way Vanguard does it. Mm-hmm. We wanted something that was custom designed that tilted heavily towards small and value in the early years, domestically and internationally, mm-hmm. and then gracefully migrated over time. Mm-hmm. And that's what we produce there. So for somebody who wants to implement that, there's a calculator on the that's available from the website. It's a Google Sheet, and they can go in and they can choose the amount they want in U.S. versus international, and they can plug in the exact date that they want to use, and they'll get an asset class allocation, and then they can go and implement that at Motif or M1 or their brokerage, however they want to do it. Yeah.
And for full disclosure, M1 is a brokerage firm that allows people to have a portfolio of up to how many ETFs? 500 or
500,
something?
500, I think, yeah.
And their minimum size investment to get started is hundreds or very little.
Yeah, hundreds of dollars.
There's no commission to trade. When you put new money in, it automatically gets invested per the strategy, right? And this, so we know that people know this, when people invest more than $1,000, our foundation gets an amount of money for opening a new account. One time you can put in $1 million, or just we're going to get you open an account, and hopefully that money coming into the foundation is going to help with our projects at Washington University and doing more of what we're doing right now.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how long we can afford you.
Anyhow. I'm going to ask for a 10% pay increase.
you deserve it. Now, this is really great work. There are other people who have, I think, taken a shot at a similar thing. I think Larry Swedrow has been an advocate of a combination of bonds and small cap value. The problem is trying to find a way to do it within the investment universe you as an individual have. For somebody who just wants to do it with an IRA, they could do that through M1, or they could do it through Schwab or a number of places. Our problem is being able to service people in 401k plans. And as I look at that list, and you've already mentioned them, but I want to go back through them one more time. We've shown what would have happened if you used the target date fund plus U.S. large cap value. Two funds. Small cap plus U.S. Plus the target date fund. Then 50-50 small cap value and large cap value in that part that's going mm-hmm. to be on top of the target date. And then, of course, the small cap value. And then you mentioned the 2.5 times. So there's a whole bunch of different strategies people are going to be able to pick from. And I think, in fact, when we talk next time, we're going to maybe dig a little deeper into the best of the best of class in with ETFs and kind of
how to pick the funds that you use for these.
So
that'll be part of it.
The education continues, and hopefully the motivation will continue. And let's hope. I'm looking for lots of feedback from our readers and listeners. I want to know whether, as you see what we're recommending and you think about your children and your grandchildren, how does this sound as a strategy that they would be able to keep up, as opposed to the 10 or 12 positions that we might have in one of our worldwide strategies with equity and fixed income, et cetera. So, do we have anything else that we need to cover today, or do we get to have lunch?
I think we get to have lunch.
All right, now we're talking. Well, I really do appreciate you joining us. I hope you'll pass this video or the blog along. And Chris mentioned a couple times the article. I forgot to mention it early on, I think. Rich Buck and I will have written an article that will be out on MarketWatch about the week of October 20-something. And in that article, there'll be a link through to Chris's article, but you'll be able to go to the paulmerriman.com site, and we have a new page. In fact, you don't even have to go to paulmerriman.com. You can go to twofundsforlife.com, and you'll be able to see a page devoted to the work that Chris has been working on here, and the podcasts and videos and we'll start a Q&A there so that you can start firing questions at Chris, and we'll hope to get you understanding and comfortable with this strategy. We know there are a lot of you out there that love to dig into the details. Let's hear from you. Test us. Challenge us. That's what we're here for. Thank you, as always.